have a favorite moment at a dinner party. It's not the first bite of food after waiting for everyone to get there to dig in, though that is pretty good. You might be thinking it's walking in the door and seeing all of my loved ones' faces. That's great, still not my favorite. It definitely wouldn't be the cleanup, though there is something so satisfying about finishing putting everything away after a fun time. And I do love the many conversations all happening at once as people catch up and joyful of laughter from across the room enter the conversation you're having with someone else. But none of these are my actual favorite moment. My favorite moment at the dinner party doesn't happen every single time, but when it does, it's the absolute best. It happens when the meal is over. The kids have tired themselves out and maybe even gone to bed. Those who have had to leave early have left, and then a few of you stay and linger. You linger because you don't want the night to be over. And also because there's something still unfinished that needs to take place, usually some conversation that's been brewing. There's something about getting to this moment in an evening where people become honest in ways they hadn't before, in ways that wouldn't have fit the earlier part of the evening with all its beautiful chaos. The conversations that happen in this honest and safe space aren't always easy, but they're profound. Tears may very well be shed, but in them a form of healing takes place. In this moment, you don't feel rushed to be done. Time becomes somewhat irrelevant. All you need to do is simply be and be honest. I've had some of my most profound conversations in these moments. I've witnessed levels of vulnerability and found the space to be vulnerable myself. These are the moments where I have experienced so much love and care and tenderness from and for my family and friends. These moments might fade from your memory, hard to capture again, but I'd confidently guess that I'm not alone in having this kind of experience in this room, that others in here have experienced this moment after the meal, after your hunger has been satiated and the noise has died down, the moment when you linger, and in the safety and comfort of that space, you begin to be honest. Honest with each other, as much as honest with yourself. I think that's the moment that Peter and Jesus have in our passage for this morning. They had this amazing miracle of a huge catch of fish, a delicious meal together that Brent preached on last week. And maybe now people have broken off into smaller groups for conversations. And Peter finds himself alone with Jesus, in a conversation that brings forth much needed honesty. It may seem odd that Jesus asks Peter the same question three times, but I think it is so intentional because the repetition of the questions mirrors an earlier part of the narrative before Jesus died and was resurrected. The night that Jesus was put on trial and wrongfully condemned to death was chaotic in so many ways. It was no doubt terrifying for those who were following Jesus. Tensions were high and fear was palpable, and in the midst of it all, Peter was asked another question three times, a question about his relationship to Jesus. So this mirroring of the three questions makes it clear that there's something happening here that ties these two stories together. Many of us might have heard that story before and know it as the time that Peter denies Jesus three times. And certainly there's something going on in the various gospel accounts of this narrative where that isn't entirely wrong. However, there's a distinction in the Gospel of John that I think is key to understanding this later conversation with Jesus. In John, Peter is asked if he is one of Jesus' disciples. The question posed to him three times is about his identity. Is he a disciple? And he says no. So in a very real sense, This wasn't exactly a denial of Jesus in the Gospel of John, but it is a denial of himself. These three denials of Peter's own identity live in the background of this interaction. And I think that background is the key to the two things Jesus does in this conversation with Peter. First, he asks him a question, and then he gives him instructions, and he does this three times, again, mirroring Peter's denial of himself. His question, do you love me? I find it interesting he doesn't ask, are you my disciple? And I wonder if that's because Jesus, as he often does, is trying to get to the deeper thing here. This isn't about Peter atoning for denying Jesus, but about reminding him of who he is. Peter is one who loves Jesus. His denial of being a disciple was a fleeting moment, one that Peter no doubt has carried shame about since. I wonder if his exuberance earlier in the passage, where he jumps into the sea and hauls the fish in on his own, is in some way an attempt to deal with his regret and shame. So there's something beautiful in this question and Peter's response that feels like a coming back to his identity as one who loves Jesus. Even Peter says not just that he loves Jesus, but that Jesus knows this already. Jesus isn't asking Peter this question because he's not sure what Peter will say. That is a way of reminding Peter that this is who he is. Jesus knows that his moment of fear, that awful night long before, is not his defining factor. He is not a denier, just as Thomas is not a doubter. He is one who loves Jesus. And it's that love that necessitates the instruction after each question. Feed and tend my sheep. Well, if you'll excuse me, I'm going to pause for 1 second and get my coffee because I have a tickle and I don't think I'm going to make it all the way through. And I don't want to miss what I'm doing either. Okay. Thank you. Love that necessitates the instruction after each question. Feed and tend my sheep. If Peter's identity is one who loves Jesus, it necessitates action. It necessitates that love being not just for Jesus, but for those around him. This pairing of love and action encapsulates the greatest commandment that Jesus taught them earlier on. Love God and love your neighbors. He loves Jesus, and this love necessitates the next step, care for others. Love others by caring that they're hungry and need to be fed. Love God, love people. Jesus tells Peter not just to feed others, but to tend to them. And I love this word because it feels like a callback to the very beginning in the Garden of Eden, when Adam and Eve were tasked with tending the world around them. It's an act of service to tend to something. It requires slowing down, paying attention, listening, and acting not for yourself, but for the sake of the other. So this too is what it means to love. Feed and tend. So three times in all, Jesus asks Peter if he loves him and then gives him an instruction to love others. He says, feed my lambs, tend my sheep, feed my sheep. Gently care for those around you, feed them, tend to their needs. This is what it means to love me. This is Peter's identity as a disciple encapsulated. And it's ours too. Centuries of Christians have lived this rhythm of the life of faith, loving God and loving people. The roots of the Methodist tradition, of which this church is a part, began when John Wesley and a group of his friends wondered how they might build a system for living this rhythm. So they would get up early, they would join together in a small group where they would study the Bible and pray and show their devotion and love to God. And then they would immediately leave together, having pooled their money and resources, and would go to places like the debtors' prisons that were oppressing the poorest of the poor, and they would pay down their debts. Love God, tend to the flock. This system or method is where we earn the title Methodists. First used in a condescending way, but then we owned it. Because this is the heart of what it means to be a disciple of Christ, to live this rhythm. Now, a few years ago, I took a seminary course for my ordination process on the worship and liturgy of the church. And during each section that focused on the sacraments, of which the Methodist Church has two, baptism and communion, we were tasked with taking a closer look at the elements used in each. So in baptism, water, in communion, bread and juice, or food. Water and food. Our assignment was to research the watershed of wherever we were living at the time, as well as the statistics around food and nutrition insecurity of our neighbors. Then we were to think and wonder and write about what it means to engage with these sacraments in light of what we learned. What does it mean to be baptized with water if your community doesn't have access to clean water on a regular basis? What does it mean to share in the meal of communion when your neighbor is struggling to put food on the dinner table? Now, I could preach a whole other sermon or two or three or five about those questions, but that's not this sermon. But I mentioned that assignment this morning because it's profoundly changed how I approach scripture now. And so I couldn't help but think about that assignment this week as I kept pondering this phrase, feed my sheep. I couldn't help but wonder what it means to feed others when grocery prices are going up and up and food insecurity is rising. What does it mean to be tasked with feeding others when the famine in Gaza and Sudan increases with each passing day and humanitarian aid is systematically being cut and literally attacked? And I wish I could answer these questions with a clearly laid out plan that will solve our problems. But I know that if we are to take seriously this invitation for what it means to follow Jesus, we have to wrestle with the reality of hunger in our world that doesn't have an easy answer. Because this command to feed people is not a metaphor. Let's not forget that Peter had just hauled in 153 fish. That's way more than he could have used. I think quite literally Jesus is meaning for Peter to share. I find it so compelling that Jesus tells Peter to tend once, but to feed twice. It's almost as if the invitation to tend is too vague and Jesus really wants to get the message through to Peter that to love others is a tangible thing. And while the factors in the world around us that limit people from being fed are complex and hard to unravel, the command itself is the most simple thing. So whenever you're in doubt, find a way to feed your neighbor. If we're to accept this invitation to love our neighbors by feeding them, we're going to have to get creative. We're going to have to pool our resources, make sandwiches for the community fridge, learn how to do more with less, and keep fighting the injustices that are making this our current reality. I think we're going to have to keep the pressure on elected officials that have allowed famine and genocide in Gaza to go on for this long, to keep pushing for humanitarian aid and an end to violence for good, near and far. Friends, I know that things feel dire right now. Maybe you're in a place where you've been feeling overwhelmed by the state of the world around you. Maybe that overwhelm has pushed you into overfunctioning, doom-scrolling, and constant dread. Or maybe that overwhelm has caused you to withdraw, to avoid, and maybe even feel a little guilty for not doing more. Whatever this season has manifested in you, know that you're always invited to come to that place, host the meal, the place of honesty and tenderness with Jesus. Be reminded that your moment of deepest fear and shame doesn't define you. What defines you as a follower of Christ is your love for God that manifests in your love of neighbor. So when you start to feel out of step with this rhythm of the Christian life that calls us to love God and love our neighbors, take a moment to pause Find yourself in that place of honesty. Be reminded of who you are. And then find a way to feed someone else. Love, tend, feed. Love, tend, feed. Love, tend, feed. Until this rhythm becomes a song you know by heart. For this is what it means to love and follow Christ. Amen.